Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me from the studios of WUWF in Pensacola, Florida, is Catherine Clark. She's the creator of an oral biography, My Exaggerated Life, Pat Conroy, as told to Catherine Clark. And so, Catherine, welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal.
Thank you for having me, Walter.
Why don't you tell me, well, first of all, I need to let our folks know that I first got to know you from an earlier oral biography, Milking the Moon, which was about an incredibly fabulous Mobilian, the late Eugene Walter. I didn't happen to know him personally, but I knew everybody else who used to hang out at the Haunted Bookshop with him, like Caldwell Delaney and Mary Frances Plummer and Cameron Plummer. So I don't think I've laughed more when I've read a biography than when I read Milking the Moon. It was incredible. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So you had experience getting individuals to open up and really kind of spill everything to you. That takes a lot of talent.
I don't know. I think it takes luck. I was very lucky to cross paths with two incredible Southern characters. The first oral biography I did was with a black midwife who had worked as a maid in Mobile, but was also a midwife, had been a midwife for almost 40 years, and she wanted to write a book about her experiences delivering babies. The only problem was she didn't know how to write. And my cousin married into the family that she worked for as a maid, and knowing that I was interested in Southern history and Southern culture, as well as writing, he put me together with her. As soon as I met her, I knew that I wanted the book to be in her voice, and I simply sat down with her and started recording her. That didn't take any real ability at all. It just took the luck of meeting this fascinating character who definitely had a story to tell. And the same thing happened with Eugene Walter. I was still in Mobile when the book with the midwife came out. It was called Motherwit, an Alabama Midwife Story. And Eugene said to me, "Now, darling, you must do your next one." And I said, "Eugene, there isn't a next one. I don't want to do another one of those. I did this as a favor." And he kept saying, "Oh, no, darling, this one was so well received. You've got to continue." And finally, I figured out that he wanted me to do him. And so I did. I was very, very lucky to have crossed paths with these two individuals.
All right. Well, how did you meet Eugene Walter?
I met Eugene because everybody met Eugene if you were living in Mobile. He was Mobile's grand old man. He was Mobile's reigning character. I think I actually met him on the very first day that I moved to Mobile. Somebody said, "Oh, if you're a writer, you must meet Eugene Walter." And so this was arranged for me to meet him that night of my move. Eugene was one of those who pursued friendships. He did not sit passively back. If he was curious about somebody, he would call you up and invite you to lunch, and then invite you to take him to the grocery store to get cat litter.
Yes, because he didn't drive, and his house was something of a mess, as I recall.
Exactly. A wonderful mess, but a mess. And he did not drive. And thank goodness for that, because I feel like a large part of my friendship with Eugene was forged through those car trips I took him on to go to the dentist or get cat litter or take him to lunch. Over the years, we developed a friendship that way. And so when the Motherwit book came out, he started telling me I needed to do another one. And finally, it took me a while to figure out that he was inviting me to do him. And when I finally got the message, I was very excited about the project. He'd lived an incredible life.
All right, so did you actually tape him as well?
Oh, absolutely. We sat in his cat-free room. That was the room that was filled with all his treasures and relics that was off limits to his dozen or so cats. We sat in the cat-free room from about 9 every morning until about 11 or 11:30 when Eugene started feeling thirsty for a drink of the alcoholic variety. And he would call it quits for the day.
Let's say a few more things about Eugene, and then we're going to get into Pat. Okay. And that he was a character. He grew up in Mobile between the wars. He won a prize for his first novel, The Untidy Pilgrim, a very prestigious award.
The Lippincott Prize, yes, exactly, which is why it took me so long to realize he wanted somebody else to help him put together his memoir, because we all assumed that he was going to write it himself, as he should have, based on his life experiences. He lived in Greenwich Village during the 40s, right when Greenwich Village was coming alive. Then he lived in Paris in the 50s, was part of the Paris Review crowd and a lifelong friend of George Plimpton's, and then moved to Rome in the 60s, where he became part of that Italian cinema scene. He was in Fellini's 8 and a Half and was a character actor in about 100 Italian films. And
he played what, a nun in 8 and a Half, didn't he?
He was a mother superior in Juliet of the Spirits.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And there's a photo of him as Mother Superior in our book Milking the Moon. He plays a journalist in 8 and a Half who's pestering Marcello Mastroianni during one scene of the movie.
Okay. And then he retired and came back home to Mobile, which he used to call Sweet Lunacy's county seat.
Yes, and he was very distraught over the Mobile he came back to. It was very different from the Mobile he had grown up in the 20s.
I know from my early association with Pat Conroy that he knew about Milking the Moon. So when did you actually come into touch with Pat Conroy and connect it up personally?
I met Pat Conroy over the telephone in 2009 when his last novel, South Abroad, was published, and I was assigned to do an author profile. The publicist for Pat's publisher set up our phone conversation. Pat called me, and the first thing he told me was that he'd been trying to get in touch with me for years, and I was flabbergasted. I thought that he probably had confused me with somebody else. And I said, why would you want to get in touch with me? And he said, well, I'm a huge fan of your book, Milking the Moon. And Walter, I got to tell you, this rendered me absolutely speechless. I was stunned. I didn't think that many people knew about the book, let alone that Pat Conroy would know about the book. And would be such a fan of the book. But apparently what happened is Pat almost met Eugene Walter in Rome. Pat moved to Rome when he was writing The Prince of Tides, and that was right after Eugene Walter had left Rome. And Pat said he was in Rome for 2 years, hearing everybody talk about the most fascinating southerner they had ever met. And they kept telling Pat, oh, you just missed him. You just missed him. He just went back to the States. You just missed him. Pat said he had 2 years of this. So that when he did go back to the States, he said one of the first things that he did was to call up Eugene Walter and go visit him in Mobile. So when Milking the Moon came out, Pat was very interested in the book. And so this is something that he and I talked about on the phone right off the bat when he called me for that interview. And I think it's one reason that we forged such an instant connection.
In many ways, the person who put the two of you together was John Sledge, who used to be the book review editor for
Exactly.
The Mobile Press Register. When it finally succumbed, it was the last full-time book page left in the American South.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I'm proud that I was a part of that page. Yeah.
So Pat Conrad calls you out of the blue. By this time, you've gone from doing the book on Eugene Walter. You started writing fiction. You're from Birmingham, right?
Exactly, yes.
From Mountain Brook.
Right.
And being a Mobilean, I don't want to sound too snooty about that, but, you know, you're from up there.
Right. And you're from down there.
You're right. As Sandra, Pat's wife, would talk about L.A., but Mobilians don't consider ourselves Lower Alabama. That's Baldwin County to the Florabama Beach, okay? So you have this interview with him, which appears in the Mobile paper, and then he gets interested in your fiction writing.
Yes, that happened, that very first conversation as well. Pat started telling me about his high school English teacher, Gene Norris, whom he credits with saving his life. And he went on and on about Gene Norris, and I told him this reminded me very much of my own high school English teacher. Mine weighed almost over 500 pounds at one point. It was a real character, completely over the top. And I started telling Pat about how this man saved my life. I just thought I was going to make a point of connection, just strike a chord. And Pat was very interested in hearing about my teacher, and I happened to mention that I'd actually written a novel with this teacher as the model for the main character. So that's how I ended up sending Pat the manuscript of my first novel.
And that was The Headmistress's...
The Headmaster's Darlings, yeah.
I have read that as well. In many cases, the man you describe is Eugene Walter-esque.
He is. He absolutely is. And I think that's one reason I connected so quickly with Eugene, is because I had met a character like him before in my life. And to be honest with you, that novel I did about my high school English teacher started out in my mind as another oral biography. I wanted to sit down in a room and record my English teacher. I even proposed the project to him, but he was in ill health at the time, another reason I proposed the project. Anyway, he passed away before we could do anything about that. And finally, one day the light bulb went off in my head, and I realized, heck, I'd always wanted to be a novelist. Here, this was life telling me to write a novel, finally. So that's what I did.
When it came out, how did the people in Birmingham and Mountain Brook react?
All I saw was a wonderful reaction, because Pat Conroy accompanied me to Birmingham for the launch of the book. And it took place at my old high school, where all the people who attended the launch, and there were a lot of them, were familiar with the teacher that I had based my main character on. And they were all very grateful that I had written the novel. They said, oh, you brought him back to life. And I think they were all very gratified for the recognition of Pat Conroy, of their school, and of this teacher who had been such a big part of this school. So I didn't really have to be subjected to the general Mountain Brook reaction. I saw a very select slice that was based around the community of my school.
Well, the reason I threw that out there is because when we get around to Pat, one of the things he says throughout your conversations is every book he published teed somebody off.
Right, right.
And
yes.
It's almost as if he were courting that kind of reaction, although his first book, The Boo, which was based upon an officer there of the faculty at the Citadel.
Right.
He meant that as a tribute to the man.
And it was a tribute, and Pat was completely unprepared for the negative reaction that the Citadel had to the book, but it was because the Citadel had demoted the Boo. He had been demoted from the commandant of cadets to some lowly job ordering supplies in a warehouse, and the Citadel took it as criticism of them, and they banned the book, and there was this hue and cry, and Pat was completely unprepared for that.
Well, first of all, he is a Citadel graduate. He wears the ring. He, over his lifetime, he had a love-hate relationship with the institution. But when you say things like, lesser men got rid of a greater man,
yeah.
Now, that's pretty incendiary. But yet it went through several printings, largely because Citadel cadets, alumni, bought it.
Right. Well, Pat said, whenever you ban a book, sales go through the roof. So the sales were good, but Pat didn't like the criticism that was hurled his way. He didn't think he had deserved that, and it upset him.
Well, you know, it's interesting because on a number of occasions in your conversations, he said he never read his books once they came out, and he never read what anybody said about him. Well, we know darn good and well he read what people said about his books.
Well, I think he did early on. I do believe that one of the things he did to protect himself was to wean himself away from reading reviews of his works, because there often was such a vitriolic reaction from various segments of the community he lived in or his family, and he called it the shield. He had to erect a shield between himself and public reaction to his works.
He did, but this is the same Pat Conroy that I witnessed sitting 2, 3, 4 hours signing books and talking personally to everybody who came through that line.
Yes.
There was another side of that Pat Conroy. He didn't put a shield between himself and
his readers. No,
and his
he
readers.
Didn't. No, not at all. The shield was between himself and the critics. And also, we had several conversations about the shield for the book, and some of this went into the book. The shield was also something to protect him from the side effects of fame. He didn't even want to read articles about himself. I remember asking him about that article that the New York Times published after he had reconciled with the Citadel. And it was a feel-good story, if ever there was one. It rehashed all the years of negativity and criticism and recrimination between Pat and his college. It traced the whole journey from that starting point to the reconciliation and the resolution. And it was a great article, and I asked him about it, and he was unaware of what was in the article. And this is how I found out that he didn't read about himself, and he knew the article had been published and he was quoted in the article, but he never read the published article itself. And that's when he told me, "I don't read about myself. I don't think it's healthy. I see my name in an article and I turn the page." And so the shield was to protect him from critics, and it was to protect him from side effects of fame. But he loved his fans. He loved his readers. And I had in one of our conversations, I asked him how he felt about never winning any major literary prizes like the National Book Award or the Pulitzer Prize. And he had this to say. He said, well, he thought to a certain extent he was being quote-unquote punished for being commercially successful, and then he wasn't even considered for literary awards because if his works were popular and commercially successful, then how literary could they be? That was one thing he said. But what else he said was very interesting. He said, I really don't care about the prizes because I have the best readers in the world. my readers actually, they don't just buy my books. They read my books and they love my books and they come talk to me about my books and how my books have helped them. And that meant the world to Pat. That was the reason that he wrote. And I think he got so much gratification from having these readers come up and share their stories with him and tell him how much his works had helped them with their suffering and their pain.
Catherine, we need to do a station break. This is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Catherine Clark about her oral biography of Pat Conroy entitled My Exaggerated Life as Told to Catherine Clark. Before the break, Catherine, we were talking about this shield that Pat Conroy set up between himself and the critics, but also shielding himself from getting a big head.
Yeah.
And one of the individuals who influenced him greatly in terms of writing and so forth was the late poet James Dickey. Pat talked about one of the things, the problems with Jim Dickey in his later life is he was never the same after Deliverance, the movie mm-hmm. came out.
And Pat was actually in his classroom when Deliverance was being filmed, and Dickey was a consultant for the film and was often away filming and would come back to the classroom and start bragging about how he had shown the actors this, that, or the other. They didn't know how to do it. They didn't know how to say it. And he had to show them how to do this, that, or the other. And he was so full of braggadocio. And Pat was taking all this in. Pat, at this point, had only self-published The Boo. His first book, The Water is Wide, which was published by a New York house, had not yet come out. So Pat is very much a fledgling writer at this point. So he is observing this writer at the peak of his career become a braggart and a narcissist, and then at one point brag about having slept with all the women in the class. And Pat would observe him walking around campus with a trail of female undergraduates walking behind him. And this just completely disgusted Pat. And he said that he felt like he was watching fame destroy the soul of a poet.
Despite watching these sad scenes, and in many ways they were sad, he still loved James Dickey. We were together on a program where he defended Dickey because right after his death, James Dickey kind of fell out of the literary canon,
and
Pat became very defensive and protective of a man who had been a literary influence on him.
Yes, but the distinction Pat always made with me, Walter, is he loved Dickey's work. He thought his work was brilliant and beautiful. But he did not like James Dickey, the man, and did not want to emulate him as a human being. And he saw James Dickey as a role model of what not to be, what not to become if he himself ever became famous. And I think he took those lessons to heart. I know he did.
Well, at times in his life, certainly before he married Sandra, Pat had his own difficulties, not so much with fame and fortune, but with, I guess, his lifelong Irish depression, as he would call it, relations with his family, and his love of drink.
Yes, yes. Pat had demons galore. And there actually was a period in his life when he did become famous. This is, in some ways, an irony of our book, is that when Pat did become famous, he did indulge, if that's the right word, in a period of womanizing, which he came to bitterly regret. The way he explained it to me was that because of his strict Catholic upbringing and then, you know, his college years at an uptight all-male military academy, he'd never really dated. And he told me, I think I married the first woman who really wanted to kiss me. And then he becomes famous, and he says, I suddenly had women coming after me. And he says, I didn't handle it well, and I let it mess up my marriage. And he blamed himself completely for that. And he didn't, it wasn't ego for Pat like it was for Dickie in terms of having these affairs with women. And he realized that it was messing up not just his marriage, but his life. Once he understood this, he turned a corner with that. But yes, he had problems with alcohol all of his life. And he's very candid about that in the book, very forthright about his alcoholism.
And also, he was an incredible cook. He liked to eat. He would talk about being the whale on the beach. But one of the sad ironies of Pat Conroy's life in terms of getting healthy the last two or three years of his life, he lost weight. He went on a diet.
He'd worked out with a personal trainer. Oh, it's so sad. Yeah, I know.
And dropped the alcohol. I mean, he used to say Sandra just gave him nothing but rabbit food.
Oh, yes, I know. We all thought that he had turned a corner with his health and was taking control of it. And I know that's what was so devastating about learning his diagnosis with pancreatic cancer.
Well, let's take a minute now and talk about how you put this book together. Pat kept hitting around for a while, like Eugene Walter, and it took you a while to get the message.
Yeah, it did. Sometimes those light bulbs don't go off as fast in my brain as I'd like them to. Yes, Pat and I like to say that conversation Pat and I started when I interviewed him for the author profile never ended, because Pat kept calling me back. And I learned later from his good friend Scott Graber, who had been with him at the Citadel, that Pat had a list of what Scott called telephone friends, people that he could just call and talk to for hours. And that and the way Scott described it, he said, Pat conducts a lot of his social life on the telephone. And when he told me that, I then understood what had been happening with me, that I got added to the list. And Pat would call me two or three times a week, and we talked for about an hour. And this went on for years. And it was the privilege of a lifetime to talk to Pat Conroy two or three times a week for an hour.
And generally at night.
At night. Usually he'd call me about 9 o'clock my time, 10 o'clock his time. Apparently Sandra, his wife, likes to write at night, and Pat didn't. And so usually the phone call would end. Pat said, well, Sandra's coming up to bed, so I'll see you later, kid. Talk to you later, kid. But this went on for years. And at one point, Pat said, you know, Catherine, if you'd been recording all the conversations we've been having, you'd have a book by now. And gosh, I was flattered. I was honored. I was also terrified, though, Walter, because I did know what Pat was getting at. I wasn't sure that he was seriously proposing a project together, but I didn't even want to try to find out, because I was scared of the prospect of doing a book like this with Pat, because I didn't see how I could do something that would be fit to stand on the shelf beside The Prince of Tides and The Great Santini and The Lord's Discipline. And I didn't want to try and fail. And I didn't want to fail and have Pat be disappointed in me. Not that Pat Conroy would ever have said he was disappointed in me, but I knew I was going to feel it. I was going to know if he was. And by this time, as you pointed out earlier, Pat had become my publisher. He published that first novel of mine, The Headmaster's Darlings, and under his encouragement and tutelage, I had kept on writing novels. His imprint, fiction imprint, that he started at the University of South Carolina Press was slated to publish all four of my Mountain Brook novels. And I didn't want to jeopardize Pat's respect for me. I didn't want to rock the boat. I just did not think that getting into an oral biography project with Pat Conroy was a good idea, just because I didn't think I could do a good enough job at it. And I just didn't want any part of that. And so I just treated it like a joke when he threw that out there, and didn't bring it up again, never mentioned it again. And then several months later, Pat had a horrible health crisis that landed him in the hospital for 2 weeks, and he almost did not make it out. His alcoholism had finally caught up with him, and he had other health issues as well, and he almost did not survive. And when he came out and called me, he told me that the experience had forced him to put together his final to-do list. And, of course, he's making a joke out of it, as he made a joke out of everything. And he told me that what was on that final to-do list was to cooperate with a biographer. And when he said that, after what he had been through, I knew he was reckoning with his mortality. And I knew that he was really serious about this. And this was the second time he had put this out there between us. And so I just made a snap decision that I knew he really wanted this, that if he really wanted this and was really asking me to do it, that of course I would do this for him.
What is the time frame? What's the date of this? When
that would have been in 2013 that this happened. And so, yeah, we actually started doing some recordings in 2013, but it wasn't until 2014 that we actually began recording every day.
And talked 5 days a week for about an hour and a half for 5 months. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Pat would call me about 9 a.m. my time instead of 9 p.m., and it was 10 a.m. his time. Yeah, we talk for about an hour to an hour and a half, sometimes 6 days a week. Sometimes if he felt like it, he would call me on Saturday, and we'd record. Again, it was the privilege of a lifetime. And I thought initially that I was going to need to do this project like I had done the other two. I was in the room with the midwife. I was in the room with Eugene Walter when I recorded them. And certainly Eugene Walter needed a live audience. Eugene was a performer, and he needed that audience that he was looking at and talking to, and he could see their reactions and their facial expressions, and he needed that immediate gratification. And I just assumed that any raconteur, and Pat was certainly a raconteur as well as a great writer, I just assumed that any raconteur would need a live audience. And so we initially did a few interviews in person. But what's interesting, Walter, I found out that Pat was actually more guarded with me in person than he was on the phone. He seemed a little shy. He didn't reveal himself, didn't spill his guts as much, or didn't seem to me to be as free when he was in the same room with me. And I remember thinking to myself, I think it might be better if we're not in the same room when I'm recording him, because I was assuming I'd have to go up to Beaufort and spend a summer in Beaufort and record him. And we also had this rapport of talking on the phone. We'd been doing it for years, so we had a groove. And so I proposed that we try recording on the phone, and it worked out great. It really wasn't like interviewing him at all. It was just like an extension of the conversations that we had been having for years.
How did you go about taking this wealth of material and producing a book?
The recordings were professionally transcribed. And I'd put all these, just pages, hundreds of pages of transcripts in binders, and just started reading through them, blacking out sections I knew would not be useful and highlighting sections that I would. And so that's the first step. And then I start just reading my highlighted passages and then just sort of let that settle in my mind and start thinking of how I might want to organize the material. So everything is Pat's words. It's just I have selected what words go on the page and what order they appear.
Well, they're gems throughout the book, but just in the very first chapter, he's trying to get The Water Is Why, a New York publisher, and actually he's trying to get an agent. He's told he needs an agent, and somebody gives him the number of a very famous New York agent, and he gets put through by shooting a typical Conroy story about being a distant cousin
right.
of the agent, and he has to report somebody's family death. And the agent, when he gets through this BS, slams the phone down, and Conroy
right.
then writes a letter.
Yes.
Dear Mr. Bach, obviously your soul has withered in the canyons of New York City, in the alleys and darkness that you walk through to get to your office each day. Whatever your mother thought when you were born, when you were suckling at her breast, she did not know what a small demon she was making. Such rudeness and such discourtesy I have never encountered in my life before, and I hope I never do again. And he sent that letter off. It got a reaction from the agent, who, after lecturing Conroy about being rude and saying he was a loser, said, send me the manuscript.
Yes.
And the rest is history.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Catherine, I mean, I can hear Pat saying that. I mean, he...
Yeah.
His way with words, I bet Julian Bach had never been talked to like that.
Obviously he hadn't, because it did get a reaction. And Julian apologized by way of saying, you know, I don't have any Southerners as clients, and I'm kind of proud of it. I'm like,
well,
he got a Southerner in Pat. And Pat reports that Julian told him toward the end of his career that Pat had made more money for him than any other client had ever had.
That goes hand in hand with one of Pat's sayings. He said, I came of age when I found myself the most hated human being, the most loathed and despised and castaway being in human society, a white Southern male.
Right, right. And later he called himself, you know, lost to albino buffalo on the American plain, something like that, yeah.
And, of course, that defensiveness comes through in The Prince of Tides.
Yes.
It's something that, quite frankly, not just white Southerners, but Southerners, regardless of race or gender, feel in dealing with the outside world, the New York big time or the San Francisco.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It infuriates me to this day. I mean, Southern fiction is no doubt the strongest aspect of American fiction. Southern fiction is one of the great gifts that American culture has given to the world, and yet we can't get no respect in New York. I mean, it's just infuriating.
Catherine, we've got about 10 minutes left. Why don't you share some things that you learned for the first time in these conversations with Pat about the biography, and then share a couple of your favorite stories.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you asked this question, because there were lots of things that came out in our conversations that I didn't really have a way to put in the book because of the way I was doing the book as a narrative rather than as a question and answer type of formatted book. But one of the things I asked Pat in one of our conversations was for him to, I said, what were the five happiest times of your life? Okay. Number one was his year of teaching at Beaufort High School. That was the year after he graduated from the Citadel. His second favorite memory was of the trip he took to Europe the summer after that first year of teaching, when he went with Bernie Schein, his best friend from forever, and two other teachers. That was his second favorite memory. Third favorite memory, third best moment of his life was his senior year at the Citadel, he said, because he knew he was going to get out of the place. And the other two happiest moments, best memories, were basketball games that he played for the Citadel. And I said, Pat, are you serious? He said, absolutely, perfectly serious. I said, those are your five happiest moments. Those are the five best moments of your life. He said, yes, what's wrong with that? I said, well, for one thing, all of these moments happened before your first book was published. And he just started laughing almost hysterically. He said, are you serious? I said, Pat, think about it. All of this happened before you published anything. And he said, well, he said, I guess that's right, because publishing has brought me almost nothing but grief. And he was very serious about that, publishing his books, because they all caused a storm. The Boo caused a storm with the Citadel. The Water is Wide caused an uproar with his community and to a certain extent with the state of South Carolina. And then The Great Santini caused his family to turn against him, not his siblings, but his parents and grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. Then The Lords of Discipline, the Citadel's after Mulligan. And he said it just brought so much stress and anxiety into my life. And he said, I've never gotten rid of it. I've never recovered from all that. So that really, really brought home to me how he has struggled with the after effects of publishing his books, and he struggled with demons all his life, that his five happiest memories or best moments are from before his publishing career took off. And this is a man who achieved, you know, international fame and success with his books. And yet his happiest times are before they came out. That's very telling. And then there was a similar moment, because the next day, I think it was, I asked him, you know, give me your five worst moments. And I said, not including what happened when you were a child with your father. And up there on the list was losing his job on Dufusky Island. And he said it wasn't just Dufusky Island. It was, I lost teaching as a profession. That was no longer available to me. And he went on and on about how devastating that was for him. And I started teasing him a little bit and saying, okay, Pat, so you didn't get to be an underpaid, underappreciated teacher for the rest of your life. Instead, you got to be a famous, best-selling, beloved novelist. Wasn't that some compensation? And he didn't laugh. He said, not really. And he went on to explain that he thought his life would have actually been much happier if he could have remained a teacher and written poetry on the side, as he had planned to do, as he had set out to do. He agreed that all the books had brought him fame and fortune, but not so much happiness. And he thought that he actually would have ended up a happier person if he had been a teacher all his life. And that really told me a lot about the soul of Pat Conroy. And I was extremely impressed by that.
You gave him the five worst experiences or worst things that happened to him. What else?
The first thing would be the estrangement with his youngest daughter, Susanna. When Pat and her mother divorced, he did not see Susanna again for years. Yeah, that tore him apart. you know, Pat said that was really the worst thing that had ever happened to him. And he said, you know, I'd go back to my childhood and let Dad beat me up. I'd go back to the Citadel and let them haze me. He said all that was nothing compared to the pain of losing my daughter. And that was the way that he put it. So, and then Pat had several suicide attempts. And so those, that rounds out the list of the worst things, not counting the childhood abuse that he suffered at the hands of his father. But, you know, putting up there on that list the loss of his teaching job and just the loss of the teaching profession, that was a real eye-opener to me.
Well, we've got time if you've got a couple of favorite Pat Conroy stories you'd like to share with us.
From the book?
Or not.
Well, what I ended up loving the most, Walter, is Pat's brutal, brutal honesty with me. He was not in any way invested in trying to project an image of success or a facade of happiness. He told me about every mistake he thought he made and pled guilty to one thing after another. You know, he was successful, but at the same time, he wasn't that happy in his life, and he's completely honest about that. My hat is off to him that he can be so candid about his inner self and share that with me, share that with the reader, and not try to project the appearance of someone successful, which we equate with happiness. Like, if you're rich and famous, then doesn't that equal happiness? You know, Pat's big message is no, and here's my life story to prove it. I do think he found happiness at the end with Sandra, and I love seeing his journey come to that resolution where he found peace, where he did find happiness. And he was back in Beaufort with a happy marriage and surrounded by family, children and grandchildren.
And a community that loved him.
And a community that loved him, whereas before he felt kind of chased out of town after the water is wide. And here he was embraced by his community. And as he said, as he put it, I've even been asked to be the grand marshal in Beaufort's water parade.
The Beaufort Water Festival, yeah.
Water Festival, right, right, right.
Okay, well, let me ask you about the title.
Okay.
Is that his title or your title?
It's kind of a combination. We were talking about the critics at one point and how they responded to Pat's works. And, you know, he was saying, I've always been accused of being melodramatic, of being over the top, you know, that I have exaggerated plots, that I have all these unbelievable aspects to my novels. And Pat said something along the lines of, you know, it's not so much that I've exaggerated in my work, it's that God has exaggerated in my life. And so I took from that what he meant was that his works reflect the exaggerated nature of the life that he lived. And so I just kind of drew the title from that.
Well, having known Pat for as long as I did, he comes to life on these pages.
Oh, that's great to hear.
He does. And just as when I read earlier the letter to the agent, that was a Conroy I knew. But then when he's talking about dealing with his wife and separation from Susanna, I've heard that Pat Conroy too. But then the last decade or so of plus of his life with Sandra was such a different Pat.
Yeah, yes.
He was at peace.
He was. He was. Yeah. And he had achieved it. He had arrived at it. Yes.
Catherine, I really hate this, but Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign.
Sure.
So, any last words for our listeners before we sign off?
Just that I wanted this book to allow the reader who never met Pat Conroy to feel like they had met Pat Conroy by the time they finished the book, that they had been in the room with him and heard the stories of his life just like I did.
Well, I think that's a great way to sign off. And Catherine Clark, the creator of an oral biography, My Exaggerated Life, Pat Conroy, as told to Catherine Clark. Thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. When you say the word biography, people are thinking something that's going to be dry, academic, and that's not what Catherine Clark set out to do. As she said on more than one occasion, I wanted people who have never met Pat Conroy to read this book and think that they were meeting him for the first time, or they were sitting on their back porch having a conversation with him. And with that goal, Catherine Clark has succeeded admirably. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.